This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
The goal of this podcast since day one is to provide the best information on the Vancouver real estate market at no cost to you, the listeners. To that end, we'd like to thank the following sponsors.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one beds to three beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, we've got a phenomenal program today. We've got actually three guests on the program today, not all at once, but we have a brief interview with our good friend, property manager, and past guest, Klaus Rode. So he operates in Toronto and in Vancouver as a property manager, has almost 200 doors. So he's going to be commenting just on what's happening in the rental market right now in Vancouver and a little bit in Toronto. And then we also have a really great chat from February with Adrian Crook and Rob McDowell.
Yeah, so the interesting thing here is, I mean, first off, everybody will remember Adrian Crook, past guest, five kids, one condo.
Right.
He ran for city council last time. He's currently appealing, I think, the Supreme Court for how he's rearing his kids, and I think he's fighting the good fight there.
No kidding.
Really important figure around the city. And similarly, Rob McDowell, a friend of Adrian, two-time candidate for city council, on many boards, big in the arts community, former diplomat. Both these guys watch the city very closely and they're very engaged. So it was fantastic talking to them about kind of what's been going on since with the city council that's not so new anymore.
Right.
What the city's getting right, what they're getting wrong, what we need to watch for. But we should highlight here, Adam, that this was done in a simpler time, back when COVID wasn't even on the radar, really, in
right.
a lot of ways. And we were going to release this earlier, but then COVID hit, and so we've been really kind of focused on our COVID coverage, two episodes a week.
Sure.
And I feel like I'm kind of getting sick of thinking of COVID, so we thought, you know what, it's a great time because we're talking about stuff that's still important to the city,
absolutely.
No matter how you slice it. This is an important, really great conversation to have. So yeah, stay tuned for that. Adrian Crook and Rob McDowell.
It's great. And like you said, the council for the city of Vancouver is not so new anymore, but I tell you what they are new to. Zoom calls. I don't know if you heard this, Matt, but the infamous toilet flush on the council Zoom call the other day. I'm going to actually, secret, if you're listening, and I hope you're well, Nobody's heard from you.
You may not be.
Yeah. But if you are listening, Secret, please add that to the end of this program because it is amazing. It is like Mayor Stewart couldn't get his internet connection working. And then there's a flushing of a toilet. Everyone's screaming to mute their phones. It's a great recording. Like, and
somebody apparently took a call from a delivery person without muting. It's like just unbelievable. Like, you couldn't write this stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it
was the best. It was the highlight of my day. I listened to it a few times, but we'll try and go out on that secret. And anyways, it is great. But Matt, before we get to our interviews.
Oh, the one thing I did want to say, Adam, is the longer conversation with Rob and Adrian is a really kind of evergreen conversation about the city,
right?
Which is really useful and fun and engaging as far as I'm concerned. And then Klaus is like yesterday touching base about what happened with rents in April, what's going to happen in May and June, what does that mean for the rental market, a real on-the-ground COVID special. So we'll start with Klaus, we'll move on to Adrian and Rob after that. So if you were fearful that you weren't going to get any COVID coverage, which I'm pretty sure nobody's fearful of, yeah. We got you covered.
Yeah, for sure.
This episode.
For sure. And Matt, before we get to our interview with Klaus first, we got to remind everybody of our sponsorship, Oakwind Realty, and we have our Oakwind, well, it's not really a tip today. It's a bit of a non-tip.
It's a non-tip moving forward, which is, like I thought and said to you, is a little bit unfortunate because the Oakwind tip, I love that segment, and we're going to try and keep providing tips of our own, maybe even some real estate related ones at some point.
Right.
But Oakwind has asked us to kind of change up the sponsorship a little bit. They're still sponsoring the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast, but they're looking to, you know, not have us just say, hey, Oakwind's a great place. Everybody listen up. Oakwind's a great place, which we're more than happy to do. But now we're talking specifically to real estate professionals. That's real estate agents, people that are new to the business or are looking to make a change from a kind of stale environment at another brokerage, because Oakwind is a phenomenal place to be.
Yeah, for sure, Matt. And you know what? Just as a bit of an incentive for new agents that are looking for a change or looking to be at a very supportive and exciting brokerage, head over to oakwind.com/join and you can sign up there. If you put in VRP2020, the code VRP2020, there is a huge, huge surprise and a special secret gift.
That's right. Yeah, I think they say they call it a free mystery gift. We'll call it a huge, huge
secret gift
surprise.
Yeah, it's a very, very huge surprise. I have no idea what it is, but they are like the you get a car type brokerage, right? I mean, it might
you know
be
what?
A car.
Working at Oakwind is like having it's like a resource gift at every stage, right? They're always coming up with new things. But you're right. I think it's Morgan Brown especially who reminds me, at least, and you've said it too.
Yeah.
You get a car, you get a car, you get a car.
She's like the okra of Oakwind. Right, that was a play on Oprah,
totally.
Matt, obviously, but she's got that energy. She reminds me a lot of Oprah, and I think she's a big Oprah fan too.
Definitely got that energy. So if you're looking for that huge, huge surprise, or what Oakwind's calling that free mystery gift, oakwind.com/join. Type in VRP. I think that's kind of a Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
Without the estate.
So VRP 2020. If you type in VREP, VREP 2020, I'm pretty sure you're going to get that huge surprise as well.
Well, you'll get a call without the surprise. Yeah, there'll be no gift. So get it right. But anyways, Matt, we've got a great interview today. So let's start with Klaus here. Great conversation about the rental market in Vancouver, and he's got offices in Toronto as well. So we touch on Toronto a little bit as well and rental market amidst COVID-19.
Enjoy.
Okay, so we're here with Klaus Rode, past guest, managing broker with offices both in Vancouver and Toronto. How you doing, Klaus?
Pretty good. How are you
Doing well, thanks. Thanks for taking the time today.
Yeah, no problem. It's, nothing much to do, so definitely good to socialize.
I heard, sure. Klaus, didn't you make a Costco run earlier today? That was like the big,
the big thing?
That was the big event, yes.
So Klaus, maybe if you could start by telling everybody a little bit about yourself.
Yes, so I'm the associate broker at Century 21 in town in Vancouver, and I'm with Century 21 Percy Fulton in Toronto. I run a rental portfolio out of Vancouver. We've got 174 units right now that we manage full time. And so we've got a steady number of properties where we do tenant placements for owners that manage their own properties. And I'm hoping to set up the similar business here in Toronto. Basically moved my license out to Toronto in November.
Fantastic. And with 174 properties under management, do you get a lot of calls in the middle of the night?
Not really, no. Most of them are condos. So if it's a building emergency, that will go to the concierge or the building strata. So it's definitely not too bad. We deal with most non-emergency calls, broken carburetors, that sort of thing.
More during the day type stuff.
Yeah.
And Klaus, with the plan to set up in Toronto, you're back and forth between the Big Smoke and Vancouver quite regularly.
Yeah, pretty much every 2 months at the latest. I was actually just there in March, and I meant to stay for about 3 weeks, but had to take off early to make it back to Toronto before the whole country shut down. So that was interesting.
I think I saw you around those times. You were we were seeing a property together, and it was like,
yeah,
Yale Town was a ghost town. Like, it was right when things really shifted.
It was sort of the week that I came in. I think the shutdown slowly rolled out. So
right,
and then the week after I left,
and then back to the Big Smoke.
Yeah,
do you guys call it the quarantine. Big Smoke there, or is it just Matt?
No, it's just the T-Dot.
The T-Dot.
Yeah.
And funny, Vancouver should be called the Big Smoke, I think, or the Little Smoke.
Especially these days with all the forest fires.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, true. No kidding. Hopefully not this year. But so close, even though you're in Toronto, with managing close to 200 doors here in Vancouver, you definitely have, I would say, your finger on the pulse of what's going on in Vancouver with the changes to the Residential Tenancy Act under these kind of emergency circumstances. But what, with deferrals and everything else, but what are you seeing on the ground right now?
Yeah, I'm in close touch with my team out in Vancouver. So, I mean, we're always having these conversations. And right now, I mean, we're starting to see a small decrease in rents. Not a lot. It's about $50, maybe $100, depending on the properties. And rents, started to stabilize probably about the month before. So they're definitely not increasing. And I would say over the next month, 2 months or so, we're probably going to see a steady decrease in adjustment. Maybe $200 max, I would say, for one bedrooms. That seems to be market right now, sitting about $1,800, $1,900. Two bedrooms is a bit more complicated based on size, location, all that. And the price range with two bedrooms has always been pretty huge, anywhere from $26,000 to $3,000, $4,000. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I know on the higher end, they'll have to come down quite a bit.
It doesn't seem surprising that at least in the short term here, rents are going to come down, considering, like, and we'll get to this, but you've actually placed a number of tenants in the last week or two. I didn't even know anyone was leaving their house. So presumably to kind of lock in a new tenant is more challenging now, and presumably a lower rent is the way to get eyeballs on the property and actually secure a tenant. In terms of the doors that you have under management right now, did you see a lot of tenants have to defer in April?
We had about four people calling for deferrals, so that wasn't too bad. So April, I think, is pretty good. And for the deferrals, it wasn't the whole rent. It was just a small portion, basically just people trying to line up the BC housing grants. And they deferred that portion. And once we get the checks from the government, then, you know, the rent will be paid in full.
So four of 170 or 180 odd units.
Yeah, we've been pretty lucky, I think. But most of the people that we have as tenants are professionals in, you know, some sort of freelance or accounting backgrounds, and they're all working from home. We don't have a lot of people that are working in the film industry. Most, you know, of course, I mean, that shut down, and a lot of people are out of jobs.
Well, in the restaurant industry as well, right?
Yeah, and I was going to say, I mean, the few people that we did have were actually working in the hospitality and food industry. So, you know, that wasn't a huge shock that, you know, unfortunately they got laid off. I mean, I'm hoping they'll be able to get their jobs back fairly shortly. But, I mean, it's starting to look like we're in this for the long haul.
Just along the same line here, Klaus, so you have a lot of property managers that work with you, and obviously, presumably, you're speaking to a lot of people in the business, in the industry. Do you think is your four of close to 200 doors seems exceptional? Am I off on that? Like, would you say most people had more deferrals than that that they were dealing with the similar kind of door count?
I'd say most people probably for April at least were pretty similar. I mean, there, you know, depending on the price points, there may have been some management companies with a few more people. But overall, I think April was pretty good because most people were working for at least part of March, if not all of it. I think May going forward is going to be the more difficult one. And then, of course, June.
So, Klaus, in terms of May, and I do, it seems like a lot of people are thinking May is where the rubber hits the road. May, June, like, are you expecting a lot more people coming to you with problems paying the rent then?
We've probably had about six or seven people email this week that are applying for various assistance programs. And they needed, you know, various information for the landlords, that sort of thing. So I think definitely in May we're going to get hit a little more. I still think it'll probably end up being maybe 10% total, because I think everybody else is pretty much secure in the jobs.
So Klaus, just thinking about the landscape right now, it's obviously gotten a lot more complicated as a property manager now. There's a lot of different things to navigate. Like, what are some of the challenges right now in the post-COVID-19 kind of era here? And also, in thinking about the eviction moratorium, like, what are some of the, have you seen any issues come up, or where are the new complications that people should be aware of?
Well, the complications, I mean, with evictions, you can't give any evictions right now. So the complication comes in that if somebody really doesn't pay rent, you can't serve them notice to try to get some money from your tenants. That's why communication is key. You know, talk to your tenants, talk to your landlords, and try to work something out. And, you know, hopefully that everybody can work on a positive note here. In terms of tenanted units that are being sold, where the new owners wanted to give notice to the tenants to maybe move in, they can't serve notice right now. I mean, you could try to sign a mutual agreement to end tenancy, but if the tenants then don't move out because they have no place to go, you have no way of enforcing that. So I think that's the tricky part, is the changeover between tenants and owners, or even from tenant to tenant. If one tenant doesn't move out and the new tenant wants to move in, you've got no recourse at this point.
What if the tenant had been served notice just prior to the changes to the Residential Tenancy Act?
I think from my understanding is that it really depends on the situation. So if it was something urgent, and it's still the case, I mean, if somebody's causing a danger to the property or to the neighbors, you can still evict. That's enforceable. It's just that for non-payment, that's not enforceable. So if something was, if the tenants had to move out before April 1st, that was still enforceable. After, that's not enforceable, unfortunately. So they could end up staying.
So I'm just thinking, like, so for example, and I'm just thinking of a scenario, somebody who has purchased a property to live in has served notice, 2 months notice to a tenant who is month to month and might be taking possession, say, a month from now and not actually be able to move in.
That's right. It's because you have no way of enforcing that. So if the tenants are still there, you can't go to the courts and get a possession order or the writ of possession. So you basically, you know, have to stay in a hotel until they leave.
And then on the flip side is if that person has sold their condo to someone who's an end user, pushing out the dates will be tricky as well. So I guess a hotel is the option.
Yeah, hotel or, I mean, there's probably lots of furnished accommodation available through Airbnb at this point. So I'm pretty sure they're not doing much business right now. So there are options, and, you know, people can definitely try to work things out. But yeah, I think that's the trickiest part of the whole business right now is notices and people sort of expecting to take over properties they've bought that were tenanted and the tenants not having a place to go.
So Klaus, we talked to the CEO, David Hutnyuk of Landlord BC last week, and one of the things that came up was, and I think it's potentially overblown, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about kind of the politicization of the moment, where certain tenant advocacy groups are arguing don't pay, you know, just don't pay the rent. I think it's big in Toronto as well. Are you seeing any of that on the ground? Like a politicization of it?
A little bit. I mean, you do see it on Facebook, and I've seen it through just sort of acquaintances. But I think that's more sort of even targeted towards people that are in just total rental buildings rather than individual condos. It's a different market, and I think it's a different income bracket as well. I think the whole don't pay rent movement is mostly younger people, and they tend to be even more on a budget. They just don't have any savings built up. Whereas if you're dealing in a strata building, individually owned properties that are more high-end, it's generally professionals, and most of them are still working.
Klaus, another thing that... you know, I just had a conversation with somebody about this, and it seems, and again, I spend too much time on Twitter, all sorts of people seem to think that there's all these Airbnbs that are going to either flood the rental market or flood the resale market. And of course, Adam and I work in Vancouver, and Airbnb has largely went by the wayside because of the rules put in place by the city, and also most stratas have entirely cracked down on them. At least that's my take on that. What impact do you think Airbnb or those units that still exist are going to have on the rental market, if any at all?
Yeah, I don't think the impact is going to be too huge. I mean, we saw the big hit last year when the rules came in and a lot of owners decided to take out the furniture and go unfurnished. So I think what's left now is pretty easily absorbed in the market for just furnished rentals, especially in the short term right now, because if you have people that are looking to, you know, they can't get into their space and they're looking for something, they're going to rent something furnished. Or, you know, even, you know, God forbid, if there's a flood in a building and tenants have to move out and find something temporarily to stay in for a month or two while the repairs are being done. So insurance claims would probably pick up a lot of that slack right there as well.
Right. Well, maybe just as a final question, Klaus, you know, you've kind of given your short-term predictions of where rents will likely go and a little bit of softening in the market. How about, like, when is the bounce back, and when do you see rents, like, what are your projections for the next, say, 1 to 2 years in the city of Vancouver?
It's tough to say. I mean, you know, I mean, there's some people are saying dealing with COVID till 2022 now. So it'll be interesting. I mean, if all things remain equal, if we flatten the curve and we're over this hump in the next few weeks, I think there'll be the short-term softening, but by the fall, you'll probably see the leveling off and stabilizing of rents. And next year, rent prices will probably increase a bit because a lot of owners, just based on their expenses alone for mortgage rates and insurance premiums are really going high in Vancouver. They'll probably have to just give rental increase notices to their tenants. So at that point, we'll probably see a bit of an increase.
Fantastic. Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Klaus, but how can people, especially those looking for really solid property managers, find out more about what you're doing?
Just find me at klausroth.ca. I'm still working on the new rental site that should be up in the next few weeks as well. Or you can check it out on Century 21 at klaus-roth.ca, c21.ca. As a mouthful.
Do you want to give your number too, Klaus, or it's up to you?
Sure, yeah. It's my cell 604-760-5856.
Highly recommended. Well, thanks so much for your time again, Klaus, and be safe in the, what do you call it? The T-T-O?
The
six. Or the six?
Yeah,
the six.
I'll see you when I get back to Vancouver.
So there you have it, folks, our short discussion with property manager Klaus Roth. That was a really interesting update, and I'm kind of surprised by the lack of deferrals in his portfolio there. That's was surprising, but it sounds like there's potentially, we're not out of the weeds yet with that, that's for sure.
No, and Klaus is a great guy, great property manager, and always nice to check in with him. But Matt, this is going to be a long one, so why don't we cut to our interview with Adrian Crook and Rob McDowell.
Yeah, this is a great one as well, so enjoy.
Okay, so our guest today, you guys wear a lot of hats, so I'll try and get through this. Rob McDowell, who is a consultant, former diplomat.
Yeah, you bet.
And also was a former city councilor candidate.
Yes, two times.
Excellent. Well, welcome, Rob. And then, of course, past guest, fan favorite, Adrian Crook, rental and housing advocate and former city councilor candidate. Welcome to you both. Can you start, maybe, Rob, by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. As you mentioned, I was in Asia for about 12 years. I am from Vancouver. I was actually born in Burnaby, but grew up here, was in Vietnam with the embassy in Hanoi. Opened that up.
Wow.
With the trade section, moved down to Ho Chi Minh City, where I was the director of the trade office for Canada, and then up to Beijing, where I worked for the Canada-China Business Council, which is the big political body to organize those Team Canada events in China. And then I was the consul in Guangzhou.
Right. It's amazing. Did you get the red plate on your car?
Yes, I did. And I had the red passport too.
What is that?
I know it's fancy.
Does that
plate give
you a special?
Well, yeah, it did. But mostly it meant that you got pulled over a lot.
Really?
And also with the diplomatic passport, it was always kind of embarrassing because there'd be a big line and you'd have to go to the special diplomat line and I would always get yelled at. And
wow.
You're in the wrong line. And then you have to hold it up and like 500 people look at you going,
yeah.
Oh, what an... Anyways, yes.
Wait, but do you get immunity? Is that actually a thing as well?
Consular immunity is a bit different than diplomatic immunity.
You committed a lot of crimes.
I was consuling.
A lot of crimes.
You were able to do things, but what would you do? It doesn't make any sense.
Double park?
Do you obey the speed limit or no?
It was China and it was Vietnam, so there would be a lot of, in Hanoi, when I first started going to the embassy, I'd ride my bike like everybody did in those days. It was a bicycle city. And I remember the cops would hide behind the post. And if you rode through a red light, they would step out and smack you in the back. And it was like such an amazing way to wake up in the morning, like at 6:30 in the morning. And of course, they would target the foreigners.
But that was it?
That was like double. Oh, yeah. It was total corporal punishment. It was like, bam. There's no tickets, right? So, yeah. Anyways, that's what I got. So, thank you.
That's hilarious. And Adrian,
yeah, good luck beating that, Adrian.
I can't.
Right. I live in Yale Town.
That's right, yeah. Really boring compared to that. Geez. I mean, sometimes I still write that Five Kids, One Condo blog that I think I was on a few years ago.
That was probably 2016.
That was a huge blog, especially in Vancouver, as everything was transitioning into condo life for most of us.
That's where I was first called a shill for the real estate industry, I think. So,
right. Yeah.
But let's see. I co-founded Abundant Housing Vancouver and Abundant Transit BC. I am the spokesperson for BC Rental Project, which is a group that advocates for rental housing policy changes at the provincial and municipal level. And of course, I have five kids, and I think... some people might remember the whole kids on the bus sort of case where the Ministry of Children and Family Development here in BC had waded in spring of 2017 and said that I couldn't let my kids take the bus on their own to and from their school or be left alone anywhere, anytime actually, for that matter, until they were ages 10 or and over. So we took that to court. We raised a bunch of money and took that to court, and we're still fighting that actually. We're in appeals now this spring, so...
Wow. You're going to the Supreme Court of Canada, you're appealing it?
No, the next step is the BC Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in BC, and that's a three-judge panel.
What's been the reaction to that case? Like, have you heard from a lot of people?
Hundreds. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's been
But has anyone
crazy.
Agreed with the other side? I feel like you're so clearly on the right side of history, cuz you're the story, if anyone doesn't know it, is your kids had been riding the bus for a long time with you. They had cell phones. They were fully prepared. The youngest was, what, 7 or 8?
Yeah. So at the time of this, they were 10, 9. The oldest four were taking the bus. They were 10, 9, 8, and 6, I think.
And somebody saw them riding the bus together and reported it. Right. And
who does that exactly? And there was no incident or anything. Like, there's never been a safety incident with the kids on the bus, and their bus drivers are all hugely supportive and offered to write us letters of support. And even the ministry said that I had gone above and beyond what any parent could be expected to do to train their kids to take the bus. But it was one of those things where the ministry has sort of an unwritten rule around age 10. And they, even the first time they visited me on this, when they sort of first commenced their investigation, they said 10 was the age, and they pretty much hewed to that and stuck to that throughout. So
that must have been, did they come to your house? This reminds me of Marriage Story. I don't know if you guys have seen
it. That. Totally. That was hilarious.
You're like, and this is a normal way we eat dinner. Yeah.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they came to the house initially to talk to me, and then they talked to the kids at the school. It was, you know, it's not a great process. Like, as the ministry pointed out, even during our trial back in September, when we first took them to court, like, every parent lives in fear of the ministry giving them a call one day. And that's really the heart of this, is that power imbalance that the ministry has to kind of essentially make you do things that maybe they shouldn't be able to make you do.
Right.
Well, good luck with that.
Thanks.
That's no, but I mean, honestly, it does seem like you're so clearly on the right side of history here that I hope that it works out in the way that it should. The reason we asked you guys on today is you guys follow city politics pretty closely. You're also both very active and both, I would say, ideas guys, right? You have a lot of ideas. Maybe a good way to get into what's going on in Vancouver and some of the positives and negatives is, you've run once, you've run twice for city council. Why did you guys run, Rob? Like, what was the impetus?
Well, for me, I have some good friends from Expo 86, so it goes back to those days. But we all live together. We all got apartments next door to each other. And one of them is now the city engineer, Lon LeClaire, and the other one is George Affleck, they were both really good friends of mine. So we all bought together, we all live together in this complex, we all are excited about the city, we all want to do something. And for
it's
George
like
and I,
it was
really, George and I, it was really a toss-up, like, who was going to run first? And so he ran first in 2011, and I helped him with the campaign, and he got in right away, so... We weren't expecting that. And he actually got elected and he ran. He was on city council for 2 terms. So I helped him with that in that time. And I certainly saw the upside and the downside to it by helping him. And I decided I would throw my hat in the ring as well.
Just thinking though, you guys are all you're young men. What you're excited about the city?
Yeah.
What was going on in the city that like?
The whole idea of living downtown, the dynamic nature of living downtown. We were some of the first people that lived in Yaletown, so that was in 2000. We bought our place in 1997, all of us in a row, and we were moving in on January 1st, 2000. So that was really exciting for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And did you see when you actually put your hat in the ring in 2014, which is a pretty it takes some courage for sure. I would guess, at least if from my perspective, putting yourself out there like that. Like, was there a few issues that you saw that you were like, okay, this is why I want to get involved? Or was it more like, hey, I can do this as well as anyone else?
I mean, you have to have the core issues, you know. You got to have the brand, and you have to have the issue that's tied to your name. And for me, it was definitely, I was interested in housing, but in transportation as well. So those two were really key for me. But that was what drove me in my campaign.
Right.
Yeah.
And Adrian, I think we know you from abundant housing and things like that. Why did you decide to run?
Mm-hmm. Good question. I mean, I had started getting into city things with that, you know, with my blog. That sort of led me to meet the people that we started, you know, Abundant Housing and then Abundant Transit with. And you wind up just in a lot of sort of municipal and just to a lesser extent provincial government circles. You know, you're meeting with and talking to people of influence, and it occurs to you that maybe this is another way to affect change. I'm constantly torn as to whether it's better to try to affect change from within or without. Everything I'm doing these days is obviously without. I didn't get elected. And in some ways, that's slightly more, well, maybe I'm just rationalizing post-losing, but in some ways that's more gratifying. No, I don't know about effective, but more gratifying because like you can set your own pace, you can try things, you can move quickly, you can agitate in ways that you can't really do from within, where it's more about just kind of working to build consensus very, very, very slowly. So I'm always back and forth on whether or not I do it again.
Interesting. So we were talking before we went live, like we just had Gil Kelly on the show, and what came from that is, you know, we were talking to him about the city plan and how Vancouver's really at a crossroads right now was his point, and we have to make some big and bold decisions, I guess, moving forward. But from your guys' perspective, are we at a crossroads? And what is the city getting right, and what is the city getting wrong right now? Before we get into specific councillors,
that's the rest of the show.
That really is the entire. That's like another 45 minutes. Yeah. Well, I mean, in fairness to Gil, like we've sort of been at a crossroads for years now, I would say, and we've been at a more like a stalemate for even longer when it comes to major reforms, like part of what I ran on and what you saw One City run on was opening up every neighborhood for everyone, I think was the One City tagline, which is basically just getting rid of detached zoning as the zoning form that dominates 70%+ of our land use here in Vancouver residentially. So that to me should have been, I mean, we've already seen that happen in Oregon. Oregon had a statewide bill that had mandatory minimum zoning for cities over 25,000. We've seen Scott Wiener in California be trying to do that now for years with SB 827 and most recently SB 50 that was sort of shot down, unfortunately. But essentially just, you know, that those bills were upzoning around transit and job-rich neighborhoods. I think Washington State is now looking at mandatory minimum zoning. So part of what I've been doing lately is trying to appeal to the province to look at that. I don't think the province has the guts to do anything about it, unfortunately. But yeah, we've got a lot of long overdue land use reforms in the city that hopefully city plan brings us, but I'm not overly optimistic, especially since the outcome of city plan is not actually any prescriptive zoning changes, according to what we've heard.
I think the problem with city plan is that it means something to everyone and it means nothing to no one, right?
It's like,
yeah, exactly. So
I can get behind that.
As a concept, it's fantastic to a lot of people, but it really, now that the rubber is hitting the road, we're kind of seeing what they mean by city plan, and there are some concerns with it. We've always had neighborhood plans one by one in the pipeline, and the West End plan was done a couple of years ago, the Marpole plan, the Kensington plan, the Downtown East Side plan, the Grandview Woodland plan. They're huge. They take a lot of work and millions of dollars each, and a lot of community buy-in and participation. And those are always in the pipeline. So there's always two underway. We've stopped all those now, and we're doing this city plan. So we've stopped all that. And let's mention, too, that most of the development in the city has happened in the four neighborhood plans that were finished. So we're not doing anymore. There's none in the pipeline. We're doing this city plan. Nobody knows what it means. And if we look at probably the best example, I think, is looking back at the community center issue, which was we had 22 community centers all over the city. The Vision Vancouver, the party at the time, decided they would come up with sort of a unified plan for them. Every neighborhood was up in arms, and it was very, very divisive. If you remember, that kind of led to the end of Penny Ballum's reign in City Hall as the city manager. So if we look at that model, I don't think it bodes well for the city plan either, for the same reason. There are very different neighborhoods. It's going to be really difficult to get them all online and in line and paddling the same direction in the same boat.
And the more I think about this, the more I think it shouldn't be an issue left to individual municipalities, especially when you have the province with sort of critical infrastructure projects providing 40% of the funding. It should be the province that wades in and says, hey, Port Moody, for instance, who, you know, you've got a West Coast Express station, you've got two SkyTrain stations, stop dicking around. Yeah. You can't, I don't care what you think you should use your downtown area for. It has to be at least this much used for jobs and you know, residential uses, because we've invested billions or, you know, hundreds of millions or whatever it is there. That has to happen at that level. Otherwise, we get sort of NIMBY councils like you see in West Van or District of North Vancouver or Port Moody that can sort of, quite frankly, pander to like people of my parents' cohort that are comfortably housed and just, you know, using their house as an ATM at this point in life and don't really need their neighborhood changing any further.
Right. Part of our conversation with Gil Kelly surrounded this kind of this cohesive identity that the city should have. Like, who are we as a municipality, the city of Vancouver? And it kind of seems like that process is a bit of a soul searching one of trying to figure out. And that's, I think, how he framed it as kind of at the crossroads of like, we don't know what we are as a city. Do you feel like there's value there in that process, or do you think it's even a necessary process for the city to explore?
I just worry that it's going to be a lot of virtue signaling and kind of. Of course, everyone's going to agree we want to be a cohesive, welcoming city, inclusive, and all that stuff. Yeah. What does it mean? Does it mean we have to have apartments right next to, you know, our homes or whatever? It depends once we drill down to what that actually means practically.
Yeah.
It just feels like we've done these kind of exercises a lot in the past. That level of abstraction isn't what's needed at this point. Like, I was thinking the other day, and this is like really gross, sort of just more like a thought exercise. But if you've got a street in your town that's named Broadway, perhaps you should have built up to 50 stories on that. And if you have one that's named Commercial, perhaps 25 stories. And if they intersect, now add the two. Now you got 75 stories. That should be our city plan. But seriously, they were arguing over like 20 or 30 stories at Broadway and Commercial, one of the busiest transit hubs in all of Canada.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Really. It just speaks to how provincial, and I mean that in the pejorative sense, a lot of our municipal thinking is these days.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, Gil is a persuasive guy, but it does seem like, you know, we've been in crisis here for coming on a decade. And the city plan is, like, in theory, seems like a very kind of interesting thing to kind of hit pause and spend a couple years tossing ideas about.
And generating a feedback loop, which is a big part of
which
it.
Which I think they're actually having trouble getting a lot of that
they
feedback,
are.
As
yeah.
I understand.
For sure.
Because, you know, people are busy and...
And they've been burned too many times with the neighborhood plans.
Yeah. And sometimes the people that speak up are the people that...
What's the loudest voices, right?
Yeah. It's the same voices every time.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know, we are already sort of... by default doing a great job of hitting pause. Yeah. You know, like I think what did we hit? Maybe half of our rental housing targets last year in terms of approval. So it's pretty darn paused. I think what was it, in 2018, we built something like 1,300 rental units in Seattle, built 17,000 or something like that. So we are thoroughly in, you know, park right now in terms of gears.
Why? And why do you guys think, like, in a city that so clearly needs more housing, like where you see places like Seattle, you just mentioned, where they're, I mean, it's a larger center, I guess, but why are they so much, why are we so bad? As specifically, I know we can point to other municipalities, but the city of Vancouver seems not great at getting stuff built or even getting those applications passed, right? And I would guess you were involved in the large apartments, you're
Broadway
probably
and Larch,
Broadway and Larch, and others as well. Like what is it? What's specific to Vancouver that makes us particularly bad at building?
I mean, personally, I think it's leadership and the lack of leadership. This is political capital that you need to expend, right, to achieve that sort of level of density. And there's just no willingness to use the political capital of the politicians that are in the city right now on that purpose. We have five different parties in city council. Let's have 10 councillors and one independent mayor. Like, there's no cohesive leadership there. Everybody's trying to prove themselves, trying to feed back to their own party apparatus to ensure that they're all keen and still hyped up on whatever issues they have, which is not housing. And we talk about homelessness and housing, of course, being important and affordability, but nobody is willing to approve what needs to be approved, which is higher density and allowable build in certain areas that obviously should have it.
Mm-hmm. And then a lot of it is sort of the worse economics of rental versus condo. I think part of the distortion in the Seattle market is that there is a large, or there was until recently, a lot of potential liability in building condo. I think you were on the hook for, things down the line. I think they've addressed that now. But, you know, also here, it's 7 years to go from sort of pre-application inquiry to a finished rental housing development. And a huge chunk of that is something like pre-application inquiry, which is like a year or something of that process. You know, why are we forcing rental housing to go through the same hoops that condo goes through when the economics are already worse? It's harder for them to secure money, to borrow money. It's, you know, condo can just kick off once they've got a certain amount of pre-sales. There's not the same kind of thing with rental. Mm-hmm. It's a tough business to be in for rental housing operators. It's not the same kind of margins as condo. So if we want to incentivize that, we really have to put our whole hand on the scale and not just a finger. And and to Rob's point, there just is not the will to drop the political capital on, you know, with a stroke of a pen, getting rid of some of these sort of artificial drags on the rental housing providers.
Mm-hmm. If there's not the political will at this point, is it possible for it to exist? It seems like we're at a point now where, like, what is it going to take, right? Because we're in a situation in which, you know, the market's fairly distorted across the board, I would say. And it seems like it's going to remain that way. And it's very difficult for a lot of people to live in the city day to day. And it does feel like, you know, certain communities are being hollowed out. Like, at what point do you think that the scale is going to tip? Crystal ball time, I guess.
That's a really good question, because like you said, it feels like it's been about 10 years of this. And we see, you know, the latest issue is obviously that's been in the news recently is all the school catchment stuff, which obviously is a provincial issue.
Right.
But just how out of sync we've been here with the province in, you know, our emphasis on encouraging urban living, like Rob saying, you know, moving into Yale Town, as I think you were one of the first settlers of Yale Town.
I didn't say settler, but okay.
That's terrible. How gauche. In any case, I bought into that and I've bought into it throughout my life. This is not the first time I've lived in Yale Town now. And, this hasn't snuck up on us. Like, we've been aware of what we're doing as a municipality, and the province has been aware of it too forever. And yet we still have massive systemic issues that prevent growth. So schools being one of them, and obviously the approval of rental housing, which is, you know, immune to speculation and generally more tied to local wages than condo development would be. So you would think everyone could agree that we need to accelerate the construction of rental housing, but we cannot, apparently.
And the city, and the, just to be clear, the school issue is it's the Crosstown School, right? The new school that was built. This is what spurred it's on the
lack of Olympic Village as a school, elementary school, the lack of Cole Harbor. As I mean, these are communities. Yep. Cole Harbor, I mean, how long has Cole Harbor been around now? Mm-hmm. 20 mm-hmm. plus 20 years?
Yeah.
Olympic Village, maybe a little less, but...
Anything north of 16th, really, is there's an issue with schooling. Right. South of 16th, not a problem.
Yeah. Right?
Those mm-hmm. schools are empty or emptying out.
Right. Yeah.
But north of 16th, it's a huge problem in terms of schooling.
The schools were really just sprinkled around in a pattern that would serve like a largely suburban density. And then, of course, when you get into urban densities like this, they can't take up the capacity of the people that live there anymore, not even close. There are more elementary students and kindergarten elementary students on a wait list now than there are actually enrolled. So we're way out of scale for the in terms of solutions.
Hmm. That making you nervous? He just had a baby.
Whoops. Yeah.
Off to the
suburbs. We got 5 years.
I'm curious because Adrian, you do a lot on the rental housing side as well, and you're an advocate, like you said. Can you talk about maybe like some of the things that your group is advocating in terms of rents? Like, are you in support of rent control, mm-hmm. and how does that connect to incentives for developers to build rental housing? And maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't really speak for Abundant Housing anymore. I'm not a director there. I resigned that position when I was running for city council for obvious reasons. I still do. I'm involved in helping them out here and there. But I know they have this same position that we do at BC Rental Project, which is that we are not in support of rent control. There are numerous sort of economic studies that show that rent control is bad for housing supply, rental housing supply. So
right.
It seems counterintuitive. I'm a renter myself. I would love lower rents, but I want more choices in terms of rental stock, more than that. I want to be able to make my landlord sweat because I could move next door if I wanted to, if things got really bad. You know,
totally. Like,
you go down to Seattle and there are rental vacancy signs out front of buildings. Like, I can think of one building, that new Peter Wall development right mm-hmm. on the same block you live on, actually, mm-hmm. that has had a vacancy sign out in this town, and I don't think I can think of any others.
The one at corner of Drake and Richards.
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
They have vacancy?
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, that, I guess, is always the concern, because we've certain developers in the city have identified that they'll be building kind of more luxury rental housing, kind of targeting.
I was going to say those rents are high, though, right?
Yeah, and that's what that makes me think.
But this,
right?
But this is another thing, and this is a trap we get into a lot. Like, if you look at actually the demographics of Grandview Woodland over the last like 2-3 decades, they've shifted dramatically from it being a low income community to it being like a better income, you know, mm-hmm. middle income or higher income community, and they haven't built anything, and so you get displacement whether you build or not. Actually, you get more of it if you don't build, because those people that come into town and start working for Amazon, they need to live somewhere, and if they can afford a luxury rental apartment, they can live there. If they can't afford that, they're going to go into, you know, Third and Woodland and rent mm-hmm. an apartment there, and that person that was in their apartment before is going even further out. So that's generally why I support rental housing supply, even if it's at the higher end of the market, because the fact that the economics are that you cannot, without a huge subsidy from some level of government, build below market housing out of the box. So mm-hmm. it will necessarily be sort of more expensive than older housing stock. I mean, a new car is more expensive than an old one. It doesn't mean you don't need it. You do need that that new housing stock entering the market at some point, and then it can, you know, work its way down as it ages.
Right. And even... I'm just thinking, if there's one like that Peter Wall, everyone knows that building because mm-hmm. there hasn't been a new rental building right. built downtown in a long time, right? So it's like, if there's one building being built, like, of course it's going to be a luxury high-end building because it just makes sense, right, from like the economics of it. But if you're building throughout the city, presumably, the newer... It's going to factor through the market as it ages for sure, but then there's going to be different gradations of new construction geared towards different price points and different needs, right?
Yep.
Like, it just makes sense. But the fact that there's none being built, I guess, like, it's not a surprise that it's all ultra luxury, $2,700 for a one bed or whatever. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I don't know what those rents are, but I think they're
I think it's a bit less than that.
It's got to be 2,300 anyways, or pretty close to that.
We should keep in mind that's a 54-story building that was purpose-built rental, and it's, you know, almost 400 units that came out to the market just like that. Right next, just down from it is another one that just came on, right, Level and Charleston.
And Charleston, at the same time, and Charleston
that's a luxury
condos where a lot of there's just a lot of floors that are just one unit.
Right.
This exact
Very
on the other corner, right? It's very different product, right?
There was also the Aquilini development. That was a rental
building, right? Close to the Crosstown School,
Expo, yeah, Expo, and I don't know what the cross street is there, right between the two arenas or whatever. Right. But I know when the Aquilini building came on and the Wall building, and I'm forgetting a third, sort of within the same time frame, there was some speculation that the area rents had sort of declined marginally. It's very hard to track these things. Usually you get kind of bad metrics using PadMapper or Craigslist or something, which are very hard to filter out crappy data. But it did feel like there was a temporary loosening of rental prices, at least. I check Craigslist for rentals pretty much every week, even though we've been in the same place for about 7.5 years. But you kind of want to be prepared to be thrown out at any time. Yeah. So.
Right. Yeah.
Ouch.
What about, I'm just thinking of all, we talk all the time just about the policies that have been put into place, speculation tax, empty homes tax, the city kind of cracking down on Airbnb. How do you, have these policies been effective in your opinion for the rental market?
It's very hard to measure. The Airbnb stuff, maybe marginally. I don't think, you know, any one of these things is not a silver bullet. So I don't think they're sort of damaging. I don't put much hope in any of them sort of dramatically changing the fortunes. I don't know the numbers too much on the empty homes tax. I don't know if you've been following that.
It's a lot less effective than we hoped it would be. That's my takeaway from it. But I mean, you're looking at a purpose-built rental policy, right? That's really what you want to push is just purpose-built rental. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, to whatever extent we can return private units to the rental market, that's great. I'm in a private unit right now. Like my landlord is, you know, some guy that's run through a property management company. That's great. Because like I said, I've lived there now for 7.5 years with my kids, which is really atypical for this market. But what I want for more people in this market, and maybe including myself one day, is a secured rental, like purpose-built rental, basically. So if you pay the bills, you will not get whatever, rent evicted, whatever you want to call it.
Totally.
And that's just right now the reality a lot of people live in, especially in like basement suites and a lot of these sort of boutique landlords, if you will.
we've honestly, I was just having a conversation with a friend of ours last week who has been now, her condo was just sold where she had to leave because an owner, occupier, end user bought it. And she moved into a new condo and was informed almost immediately. She took over a sublease, so informed almost immediately that they were selling. And I guess she didn't have a full lease agreement in place with the landlord because she took over from a friend of hers who was renting. It was all on the up and up, but she's getting removed. Ugh. And it's the cost of, I mean, the cost to the tenant is huge, right? And when you start thinking
about both financially and psychologically and energy and
everything, right? Yeah. Taking time off work to move, meeting all the dates and everything else, transferring your telus, hanging around for, say, your internet provider to even show up.
Well, and then in a similar vein, what is becoming more and more of a problem is, and I'm in favor of tenant relocation policies, like at a municipal level, having some good guidelines in place for what happens when you've got to sort of update or renovate like a rental property. But what's happening now is, even if you're giving somebody 6 months of, you know, rent to go find some other place, they can't find some other place, or 6 months is not enough. Or we're downloading these costs of not building enough back onto the very same developers. Whereas if we had a healthy, 3-5% rental vacancy rate, maybe that tenant relocation policy doesn't have to be so onerous, so costly, because it's more expected that you could find a place, a few blocks away from where you live currently.
And I know you have a really nuanced perspective of what needs to change, but in a lot of ways, we have to build it, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, there's this appetite in town to kind of find some bogeyman, like it's foreign money, or it's money laundering, or it's a bunch of empty homes. And there's been this search for a scapegoat for years. And I don't mind doing things as long as they're not racist or xenophobic around things like foreign money or whatever, like, which is always a hole we kind of go down, it feels like, as a city. I don't mind trying things like the empty homes tax or Airbnb regulations, because they're probably part of, at least right now, an unhealthy rental market. It's probably part of solving it. But the bottom line is you need to have homes, and we don't build enough homes, and thousands of people come here every year. And last year we approved about 1,000 new rental homes that won't even come online for 5 or 6 years. So we're way, way behind the curve on the problem. And we're just every day, many people are just being forced to move further and further out. And we're building office space downtown that's literally set to house thousands of new workers, like the Amazon building. And, you know, yeah, there have been some beautiful renders of, you know, proposed office
Shopify
buildings.
And
yeah, rest, yeah, yeah, Shopify. But no, it seems like nobody is asking at the municipal leadership level where these people are going to live. And the sad fact is they will just force people, even like me, that don't earn as much as them, right out of the city because they can outcompete us for rents.
So the interesting thing about this is I felt like the last, and at least my impression was, this was like one of the major cruxes of the last election, right? Mm-hmm. Like housing was it was fairly central.
For sure.
And yet, Rob, when you were talking earlier, like, okay, so what was the result of that? Well, we have a council, a very diverse council with little to no cohesion, right?
Right.
And not the political capital or political will to do anything. Like, how, being in the trenches during that election, like, how did we end up with such a diverse, I feel like the city council's like the Democratic party's candidates here in the U.S., like,
that's right,
splintering into just, you know, randomness. How did that happen?
I think there was a couple of factors. I mean, the sort of implosion of Vision Vancouver and its after effect. Vision Vancouver is a very effective, it was so different when it came in compared to MPA and COPE, right? So Vision came in with this big model of cohesive sort of a party system at the civic level. That never happened with the MPA. I mean, with the MPA, you used to have councillors yelling at each other from the same party. Vision, they moved in lockstep.
Yeah.
They had a really strong housing policy, sort of increasing density, doing all these things with developers, essentially very pro-developer, in fact, but having sort of a green face to it and putting in bike lanes. So it was like, oh, don't look at this, look over here, right? So they were able to do that. The implosion of them and that sort of party discipline system, this is, I think, what we're paying for. That in combination with the fact that you can't, the whole funding and political
fundraising,
corporate donations, mm-hmm, union donations being banned from at city level. It's you know, it's very complicated to run a city campaign, to run for a civic election. It's what, 5 federal ridings, it's 8 provincial ridings. You have to cover the whole city as a candidate. It's an at-large system. So as a candidate, you have to go out there and meet with 500,000, 600,000 people, right? It's really hard. And you're not going to get the same quality of people running that you would at the provincial or federal level, because you don't have the professional help that you would get. So it's a combination of those two factors, I think, mm-hmm, leads to this, which is where we are with 5 different parties amongst 10 councillors. It's just, you know, this is the wisdom of the voters, right? I mean, does that sound too bitter? But it's the wisdom of the voters is what the voters were looking at. They're confused out there anyways. They want homelessness solved. They want housing solved, but they're not completely enamored with developers and developers looking at the industry either. So I think that sort of confusion is what we see reflected in council today.
Right. Interesting. It makes me think we had Gordon Price on a long time ago now.
Almost a year ago, probably.
But yeah, a crisis of confidence with the development community is, there's a crisis of confidence,
yes,
there that he was outlining as a huge challenge,
right, for sure,
for the city of Vancouver right now. If you guys had to grade the current council, and then we'll go through member by member. No, sure. Gene Swanson.
Yeah.
No, but it sounds like there's a big challenge, right? There's 5 different parties. many competing voices, a challenging situation in the city at large. How are they doing?
I would like to do the great thing after the show, though. If you guys can hang around for that.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Jean Sponsa because in so many ways she typifies what's happening, I think, which is she was an activist. They had a siege like 1 year before. They took over council. They scared all the council away. Council had to sit in a different place in the city, right? The police were overwhelmed. She sat in the council chambers, and as housing activists, homelessness activists, they took over the chambers for almost a day. So all of a sudden she's elected, and she has to transition from being an activist and an advocate to being someone who has to be a bit pragmatic. And she, obviously, you can see that she's really struggling with that.
Pragmatism,
shifting from sort of orthodox thinking to pragmatism and
I don't think pragmatic she thinks thinking. She's struggling with
I don't
maybe she's nailing not. It
but to be clear, right, she's voted down every single rental project she's voted
because they're not perfect. They're good. They're
really the people she believes she represents are the people that earn less than $30,000, which is absolutely fantastic. Obviously, those people need homes
and they need a
more than anyone in
right?
this city, sure. and they need a representative. The problem is, as I mentioned earlier, you can't build anything new that serves that without that market segment, without huge provincial or municipal or federal or whatever it is supplements like subsidization rather. Mm-hmm. So it's a foregone conclusion that no matter how affordable, rental housing developers can achieve some cross subsidy within a new housing plan by having pricing the top floors a little bit more expensive so the bottom floors can be a little less expensive and so on. But you can't get down to like shelter rate, like $375 a month prices on new construction. So,
which is the only thing she'll accept.
Only right? thing she'll accept, yeah, exactly.
And the only thing she'll vote for.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, she's just one person, and so therefore largely irrelevant, in the council voting scheme. But it is very frustrating to see that vote essentially wasted. It's a protest vote over and over and over again.
And her colleague in council, really, Colleen Hardwick. Like, they seem to vote together a lot, right. which is completely odd because they're at very opposite ends of the political spectrum. But Colleen also finds things to be troubling because they're not completely perfect either, right? Yeah. Or she's
I like
troubled
the idea
with,
of rental housing just not here.
Yeah, that's
just
right.
not the way this
not
looks.
Not across the street. That's four stories. My God, four stories.
There is a fantastic slide. I did a little talk with Sonia Trouse, who she's the sort of the grandmother of the Yes in My Backyard movement out of San Francisco. Her and I spoke over in Victoria last fall, and she has a slide in one of her presentations that is from a little study that was done that basically asked people hypothetically if they would support this new rental housing development that was coming. And they asked based on if it was, would you support it if it was a few kilometers away, a kilometer away, like a few hundred meters away. And you can very clearly chart like how support erodes the closer and closer this hypothetical development gets to the person being asked. And it's even more of a drop off if that hypothetical development has any below market component to it whatsoever.
Yeah, sure.
You don't want those people anywhere near you. So, I mean, it just undermines to me the, 9/10 of the NIMBY argument in the city. It is very much a not in my backyard kind of sentiment that prevents us from moving forward. Mm-hmm.
Tom Davidoff just released a paper called Not in My Neighbor's Backyard about laneway homes.
That's great. Yeah.
Well, we've got through two council members.
I know.
Well, this is fun, though.
Those two are exceptional because, again, they'll probably get reelected because they have a name, they have a constituency, and they're representing their brand really well.
Yeah.
The other eight are quite moderate, and they're trying to be centrist, and they're trying to be pragmatic and level-headed. That's going to work against them when they come up against 70 people running against them.
That's the incredible part of this, right, is that actually trying to get stuff done, put your head down, do the work. You get politically
doesn't
punished
get you noticed.
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, and I wonder, like, you've got an MPA. MPA is, for I'm sure everyone knows, but it's like Vancouver's oldest civic party. I think they're a little over 80 years old now. And they're probably the best brand now that Vision's gone, I guess, still in the game. And they have five council members because Rebecca's not with them,
so they just have four.
Four city council members. But their board recently took a bit of a turn to the right when they had their AGM back in December. Mm-hmm. And so I think it remains to be seen what their 3 or 2 and a bit years from now when they put together their next slate, how that looks, because obviously they already had one councilperson leave because she didn't agree with the politics of the board. But the other more interesting thing is, you know, we've got a homelessness and an opioid crisis here. You know, if you've got a far right party that maybe takes a tough on crime approach, I worry about that doing well in a city like this, you know, because you do have a lot of people that will, you know, you see this even down south where they'll tell you one thing and then vote a different way when they're alone in the booth. There are a lot of people, especially when we were on the campaign trail almost a couple years ago, that there was a lot of visceral anger in neighborhoods like Crosstown and Chinatown, downtown East Side, around the city, just sort of not really getting it right, I guess, charitably.
Right.
But, you know, ignoring them probably less charitably in terms of your interpretation of what the city's doing. So I worry that that dynamic has a couple years to fester, and a group like the MPA could run on that. To some extent. You saw Wei Young try to do it.
I mean, for me, the issue with the board and the caucus, the elected officials, is not. That's, yeah, there's pretty much a firewall there as far as I'm concerned, but they don't really impact on how the decisions are made by the councillors. However, they do select who's going to run next time. So that will impact it.
Yeah.
For sure.
And you saw, I mean, they hard selected last time around. They were like, no, thank you, Hector.
Not me. Not you.
Not me, not you. Yeah. Well, I remember. I mean, Greg Baker was like replying to me and journalists saying, like, he's not running for us. You know, he was the party president. He's since been fired. But, so, yes, the MPA does exercise some pretty extreme control over who runs for them.
Yeah, and that'll be interesting to see 2 years down the road how that will impact what their slate looks like. Yeah. Because, quite frankly, the people that they do get elected are usually the more left or centrist kind of people. That's who the voters want from the MPA. So we'll see who the MPA puts forward next time. And the other party is the Green Party, right? So the Greens have three as well. The MPA have three. The Greens have three. And that's also a party that's a bit struggling, because it's always been able to be the advocates and the activists and not really have to have leadership or show leadership in a pragmatic way. And this is why they're, I think, struggling between how they're going to enact policy within the city. Because you see different takes from Mike Weeb, from Pete Fry, from Adrian Carr. They're all very different people, and they're all they take very different approaches. They vote against each other from time to time, more often probably than I would that I would think. But that's another party that's there.
Mm-hmm. But the Green Party is full of contradictions. I think it was it Pete Fry that was advocating on saving the hedges in that 21-unit townhouse development? So there was that 4575 Granville was 21 rental townhouses that was proposed for one mansion lot.
Right.
And one of the reasons that he had for turning it down is that the hedge would be sort of taken out as part of that development. So there's,
which we should pause to think about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's just how inherently weird and conflicted they are. Like, you are literally advocating for green as the color, not green in terms of green land use. It's bizarre.
So if it sounds like you guys are, the verdict's still out on this council. 2 years from now, two questions. Would you run again? Do you think we'll see more cohesion? Is this kind of a blip and we'll get back to some sort of cohesive party? And is Kennedy Stewart still the mayor?
Well, there's a lot of questions.
Yeah, three.
You said two and then he asked five. That's right,
yeah. I'm going to add two more.
I think I'd be interested in turning over why, like, 71 candidates ran for city council last time around for 10 city council spots. And I mean, it's like, at the time it made sense to me why so many people were doing it. Now I can't remember why. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, people saw it as a sort of a generational opportunity. There was a lot of turnover. So, hey, I'm going to do this.
There was no incumbents, right?
Running, yeah, really. Right. Vision, just decline of vision. So that would have, And then also it's like $100 deposit. So you get that back, and 25 signatures to be able to run. I mean, like, we need to raise that.
Right. Yeah. And that is being discussed right now.
Who is, I'm trying to remember, Roller Girl?
Yep. Yep. Oh, there's a lot of great ones.
Watermelon. Yeah.
Guitar. Yeah. Man. Yeah. Yep.
Roller girl. Yeah. I mean, there were how many mayoral candidates? There was something like 10 or 16. 15 or, I can't remember. So,
but 71 council candidates. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if that if the field looks like it's going to shape up like that again, you need a brand behind you. Unfortunately, I think isn't Vancouver like the only major Canadian city that has municipal parties?
Seems like it, yeah. But yeah. You can see why, right? When you look at the ballot, why. You need a shorthand. Yeah. Voters need a shorthand when they see all those names. It's overwhelming.
It, right? We were talking about that before we came on air, but it is crazy. It is overwhelming.
And I that's feel like the number we were one here fairly thing. Like, I think we did podcasts on it before the election, and I still went in there and I was like,
I'm no expert, but the amount of names you're like, yeah. And I think also with people's attention spans these days, I mean,
oh yeah,
it's like, it's a tough way to vote for sure.
Yeah. Low attention voters, right? Low information voters. So, and one of the funniest events was, I think, the lottery for, it used to be alphabetical ballot, right? Oh, so they decided they would randomize and stuff.
Yeah.
So they had this lottery and everybody went there and it was just all candidates sitting in the council chambers and they put everyone's name and then they pulled the name out and the guy was screaming. It was Jason LaMarche. He goes, I win. That's what he said. It was just,
Left Vancouver. Eh?
I didn't know that.
I'm not sure.
I think he's left Vancouver. I used to follow him on, some social media.
Okay.
I don't think any of that had any bearing. I was like super stoked that I got sixth out of 71.
Yeah.
With the idea being didn't that matter. Most people would just go and
maybe you're just, it's easier to find, but I think it was a mess. Ultimately, like alphabetical for, especially in the case when you have 71 candidates, is probably a pretty, you know, good way for you to immediately find the people you want to vote for if you've done any research beforehand. And instead, we scramble the whole thing for you. Like, great.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So, I don't think they'll do that again.
They should not.
I think that was sort of
that was a bad idea.
Yeah. Staff report was indicating that. But there is a power to incumbency. So if all these 10 are going to run again, there's that power to you. You're going to be battling that if you're going to run.
Right.
So that's a big challenge.
But it sounds like you think there's going to be fewer candidates next time around.
I don't think so, not necessarily.
It's awkward, right? Because you put your name in and you think, oh, there's only going to be 40 people. And you don't find out until the list is put out. Like the weekend after everybody files. And that's when you find out and you go, oh, crap. It's like 71 people. Can I withdraw?
We already, like, as independent candidates, there was actually a lot of really good buzz around independence last time in 2018. Sure. And there was that Kosenko poll that had independence at, like, you know, above Greens. And, like, you know, if independents were a party, we'd be laughing. Unfortunately, independents were about 47 people or something that they had to split votes between. So it just doesn't break down well. And, but I think we still had our eyes pretty wide open. I mean, Rob is not new to this, and I'm, you know, not either, with a little less experience than Rob, obviously. But would we do it again? I mean, I won't speak for Rob. I would consider it, but you look at what's going on now. You've got, like, essentially 11 individuals in there, you know, 10 councillors plus the mayor, that are putting forward their own, I don't want to call them pet motions, but, like, some of them literally are pet motions. I think Pete's aggressive dog policy is coming to.
That's right.
In any case, yeah, so we're really tackling the tough issues. You know, sinking our teeth, we can get more dog puns in here. But I think I'd be discouraged spending, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday nights till 10 or 11 because you're just slogging through a bunch of work of your own creation that isn't really moving the city forward, certainly not in the files that I feel are, you know, most needed, like housing and transportation. So we'll have to see how it shapes up in a couple of years.
Yeah. It's tough, right? It's a big financial hit. It's a big family hit. It's a personal hit to run.
Yeah.
And certainly you have your eyes open about what your chances are. But I also think neither of us feel completely compelled to run. So it's like you do it just to serve, to be part of things, right? To be involved and engaged. And I think that's why you do it. So
You do it if you think you can make a difference. And I think going back to the, you know, whether you choose inside or outside of the political realm to make a difference, I think it just comes down to what your motivations are and where you think you can make the most difference. And so far, I guess by default, I've been doing it outside of that system. So, well, you know, that's been gratifying.
Right.
So it seems like we've talked a bit about the city plan, not super optimistic by the sounds of things, as far as I can tell, coming from you guys. City Council, we're not super optimistic about where they're. Are you guys optimistic about the city of Vancouver, say in the next 5 to 10,
the 20 and beyond years here? Can we get our act together?
Yes. A lot of deep breaths, yeah. No, of course. Of course we're optimistic. I'm optimistic. Yeah. You have to be, all right? People are going to keep coming here. We've created this fantastic city where everyone wants to live. Like, is that a bad thing? Yeah. I mean, you know, the fact that people are attracted to come here and live here and work here and play here, it's like, it's a fantastic place. And it will always be, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think... Like we were talking about this as we walked in around the frame of the Olympics, whether or not, I guess there's this idea that Vancouver gets the Olympics back in 2030 or at least makes a play to do that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I hear a lot of people, I'll let Rob weigh in with his opinion, but I hear a lot of people ragging on this online, like this is a terrible idea. But, you know, the Olympics brought us a lot of pretty great things. I mean, with a few bumps, it brought us Olympic Village. Obviously, the city had to jump in there and take over a lot of that development. But now it's a great example, minus an elementary school. And it also brought us the Canada Line, you know. So maybe we go and get the Olympics again and amortize some of these prior investments and build some new thing. Maybe we upzone some great swaths of the city and build a SkyTrain all the way out to UBC like we should be doing the first time around and all sorts of, you know, other fantastic investments. Maybe that's the way we shock the system into growing. I obviously love Vancouver. I live right downtown. I've bought into that Vancouver dream. I'm a little discouraged to see at the provincial level them not keeping pace with that. They, you know, on the schools issue, they're just doing sort of seismic upgrades in Vancouver, not really new schools. They're saving new schools for outside of Vancouver. They released, or they didn't really release it. They had a growth strategy drafted for the metro area that talked about forcing a lot of the growth out of Vancouver in terms of jobs and housing as a way of sort of, I don't know, dispersing growth or something, like actively curtailing growth in the major downtown core.
Which seems to be a policy from 40 to 50 years ago, right?
They were lauding San Jose and the Bay Area for how they, I mean, that's
look
a
at the sprawl.
Nightmare. Yeah. So some of the, I don't get a great urbanist take from, well, really John Horgan's government at all. So while they may be good partners for some projects, they don't have a great city building vision. So hopefully we can get a council in here next time that actually has a majority and can make something happen.
I think that would be really important to the city, is to get a majority for sure. Even 6 of the 10 councillors, you know.
We were hopeful after this that, like, after that last election, that you'd have some informal group band together, you know, the
right,
Greens.
Right, I think it was kind of the wait and see, right? Like something might cohere.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
It didn't happen. I mean, it's sort of a foregone conclusion. Like, even the Greens they didn't really caucus. Maybe they do now.
No.
MPA certainly doesn't have a caucus. So if you can't even agree within your own party, you're not going to suddenly, you know, build a bridge to another one. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And it's, and as I understand this, instead of lofty citywide plans, get 6 out of 10 on council, plow through a couple community plans, get to work. And,
I mean that, you know, if I was encouraged when I came in here today and you were talking about having Gil on and how he was, I mean, I got to go and listen to that episode now. I'm going to go home and listen to it for sure about how he was sort of talking about big dreams and that, you know, it should be within, to some extent, his power to get some of that done or to lean on mayor and council to try to put something on the table that would get some of that done.
I think we are really lucky that we have Gil Kelly.
Me too.
Absolutely. Like, yeah.
And Lon LeClair, who's, of course, the city engineer. And Sadhu has really come around from the Penny Ballant days. So, you know, we do have really good people in those key positions. And I think we're really lucky because, especially with this lack of political cohesion or direction or leadership, we're going to rely on those people to keep us moving forward. And we do have, like, I have total confidence in that team, right? Mm-hmm. In the corporate management team at the city. So we're fortunate about that.
You're right. So Sadhu Johnston is the city manager, for anyone who doesn't know. And I, you know, when we were watching council for probably, like, really avidly, or at least when I was for the first year or so after not being elected, it was Sadhu that kept that group on the rails, quite frankly. Like, they were lost when it came to procedure, when it came to what they could
do. Well, this is what Frances Beulah, we've had her on the show a couple of times, and she's, you know, it's like literally figuring out where the bathroom is.
That takes the first 3 months.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that's not a metaphor.
Yeah. He was the one that would just sort of keep them from getting inadvertently sued by someone because of some decision they made one night, you know, like, yeah. so. we're very fortunate to have that quote unquote like institutional memory. And if they can stick around for another regime that hopefully has a bit of a clearer mandate, you know, I hope it's the right mandate. I do fear that, you know, the MPA has been a little more center right in the past, and the old axis of right maybe equaling more of a conservationist stance. I don't know if that's necessarily true anymore, but if it is still true and you get like a lot of the West Side voting the MPA in, maybe we're not in a good growth position with an MPA majority. I'm not sure. So it depends what that party looks like 2 years from now.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, is it the party of Gordon Price or is it the party of George Puhle, right? I mean, they did bring in the Downtown South Plan, which gave us all of Yale Town, all that, you know, 80,000 homes. So, yeah, it's a good question. Which party the MPA will be?
Yeah, that's the that's an interesting part about that that party specifically, right? Is that it's wears many different hats or can.
Completely. It's an empty vessel between, right? That's what they call
it. Well, and you've still got other parties like Yes Vancouver had some fundraiser a couple weeks ago. I didn't go. I don't know how it went. It was $50 a plate. But, you know, so there are other
and
groups.
This is Hector Bremner's.
I'm not sure if he's
Hector still involved.
I don't know. I don't know who's organizing
that. Founding
member,
past guest.
I bumped into Stephanie Butler, right?
Yeah.
Who was one of their candidates or one of their council candidates. And I had asked her, like, are you organizing this or are you going to this? And I don't think the answer to either of those was yes. So I don't know who is behind all that. It's not Mark.
No,
is it
sure.
Mark? Mark Marison, maybe?
I don't know.
Anyways.
Well, it sounds like at the very least, we're in the muddy middle here.
Oh, yes. Very much.
Yeah. But we do have, I think that's, we should
maybe,
hit the five
maybe
wire.
Leave it there. And yeah, can you, we have this segment called the Five Wire, five questions about you in Vancouver. Can you stick around for that?
Sure. Of course.
Okay. So question number one, what is your favorite neighborhood? We'll start with Rob.
Yale Town.
That was easy.
I would say Yale Town as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay. Probably. Aww. Oh, I live there too. Come on.
I'm learning.
I was not one of the original.
Well, right, you came from North Van, if I remember correctly.
No, I grew up in Port Moody. I did live briefly in North Van, but the first place I moved into in Yale Town was actually in 1999. So, but then I moved to Mexico and other places too.
Right. Favorite bar or restaurant?
And doesn't have to be in Yale Town.
I don't make it out much anymore with kids.
With five kids.
Yeah, exactly. And sadly, we've been going to like Boston Pizza at the stadium, Boston Pizza, because it's like $6.99 for a family, you know, like a kid's meal. Yeah, so that's not terribly hip.
Yeah.
Matt is now like, going to Boston Pizza.
I don't know about that deal.
$6.99. You get three courses. It's amazing. But I mean, there are a couple. There's a place called Bartholomew now in... Yale Town, which I think when they were originally launching, they were going to call it Bartholomew's Plan, which is Harlan Bartholomew gave us a lot of our modern zoning code back in the 30s. Whoa. He's an American planner, and a lot of it is super racist. So that wasn't a great name.
Oh, right. I remember that. Yeah. I remember the racist.
So I think they just shortened it to Bartholomew, but it's a fantastic like charcuterie cocktail place in Yale Town. So when I can get an adult night, I'll go there.
Where's that?
On mainland. On mainland. 1,000 block of mainland. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah,
and my local is New Oxford, so it's just easy.
Oh, yeah.
It's easy.
Donnelly Group.
Sometimes Morrissey. Morrissey.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is, we're...
Morrissey
we must
at Davy and Granville, right? Yep. Drake and Granville.
Yeah.
That's a good...
That's been around for ages.
And hold.
Yeah.
Been around a long time.
Okay, you got these written down?
So one book that you would recommend that every listener should write.
Right.
We'll start with Rob.
Chuck Montgomery's book on Happy City.
He's been on the show.
Yeah. So one of the chapters is about me. So
really?
There you go.
I've read that book. I didn't put two and two together.
I was the guy who lived in the tower and was sad. And then I moved down to the townhouse and I was happy.
Oh, right.
All my friends
story. Didn't he tell that story on the show, maybe?
He does his presentation, yeah. And he has a big picture of my face, like it's on stage. It's like horrific.
Yeah. And is that a simplified story or is that
it's
actually what happened?
Simplified. But yeah, that's kind of what happened. Yeah. Yeah.
For me, probably this is not a city building book, although I would say oh geez, that no, what's Nathan Loster's book, The Life
oh,
yeah. and
oh,
Death
oh Life and Death of the single family Home,
right? Yeah. I mean, that would be a good one to read for specific to Vancouver, but one that I think explains a lot of sort of human psychology is The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz, which is a good explainer for just why we're so paralyzed by an overwhelming amount of choice in today's world and how sometimes less is more. So
One piece of advice you would give your 18-year-old self, coming from two guys who've wildly successful and put yourself out there.
Wildly successful. That is hilarious. I mean, now my oldest is closing in on 14. So like right now all my kids are like 13, 12, 11, 10, and 8. So like at the countdown, basically, is what you call the group of them. So I can almost give this advice to them. I think it's been more fulfilling for me to chase a bunch of things that represent my interests than it is to chase a singular vocation. And, so I, you know, when I started writing that blog, I did it because I just had a thing I wanted to talk about, and it brought all sorts of cool people and things in. That's probably 9/10 of the reason why we're sitting here and chatting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So just follow your passion. It's super trite. The older I get, the more I realize all these like, you know, just napkin
the kind of cliche,
fortune cookie sayings where you used to roll your eyes at are like, yeah, that's pretty much true.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it?
Sad.
Reap what you sow, right? So you put love into something, you'll get it back. I think that's so true. And with anything, it just is about the is it long term or short term, but you always get it back. So yeah, don't be afraid to put love out there.
Yeah.
Put interests and gauge out there, right? It's just like, yeah, it comes back to you.
Fantastic. And last but not least.
Yeah, so something that you have bought recently for under $1,000 that's had a positive impact on your life.
Oh, a cat.
You bought a cat?
What? For under $1,000?
Yeah.
Got a special cat.
You know, I've never had a cat before. My partner always wanted a cat. So I was like, okay, we'll get a cat. We went to this SPCA up the street, which is so depressing. It's just walls of cats and cages. It's like they're all rescued and there was one cat. It was just like, oh, now I'm a cat guy, I guess. So we have this cat at home. It's like, wow. It's totally changed my life. It's a cat.
More so than moving down to the townhouse? Or?
Yeah. No. But
not that much.
I would think that's had a big. The cat has had a big impact on my life for sure.
Oh, that's funny. I had been thinking of this like little. So I don't know if you've gone on my site and looked at the sort of the floor plan, or there used to be like a virtual tour of the place. Doesn't work anymore, unfortunately. I got to get a new one done. But my bedroom has like a Murphy bed in it that you can flip up and put a desk down and all sorts of cool stuff. And I had one other use I wanted to get out of that room, which was as sort of like a movie theater. So. You know, you could be in bed and then there'd be like a projector and a screen in front of you. And for under $1,000, I put that together recently. So I think the screen was $200 and the projector was $500. And I already had a set of speakers I could throw behind it. So the projector just sort of sits on top of the, you know, the Murphy bed sort of frame or whatever. And, you know, the screen is on the other end of the room. And man, that is cool. Like it's, you know, because obviously I've, you know, a bunch of other kids and they sometimes have friends over and they're all using all various other parts of the condo. So I can kind of retreat to there and, you know, turn the blinds and just watch movies or whatever, or even have a kid in there and or two and hang out and watch something. And it just is, it's, yeah, especially, I mean, it's sunny right now as we look out this window, but like the winter we've just gone through, it's been a lifesaver. So.
No kidding. And I think I saw a tour of your place on YouTube at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kristen Dirksen does, she's built quite a YouTube channel. I think she's got like 1 million-some-odd followers. And that has been viewed like 2 million times, that tour. I still, people get, like, will recognize me from that, not anything else, from that in Vancouver. So she must have tons of viewers.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big movement right now. I mean, I feel like a lot of YouTube channels on small homes and efficient living. And
I'm totally missing the boat on monetizing this.
No kidding.
I haven't written a book. Don't have a YouTube channel.
I was going to say, you were cutting your teeth on that. 2 years, one of the first.
Exactly.
Yeah, even Todd Talbot's in that space now.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for your time, guys. That was a really interesting conversation, and appreciate you coming down to the studio.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, and where can people find out more about what you're doing and about you specifically?
All of my random links are on adriancrook.net currently. Yeah, so.
And I'm robertmcdowell.ca.
Awesome. Well, we'd love to have you guys back in the future. And yeah, thanks again.
Thank you.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Adrian Crook and Rob McDowell.
Really enjoyed that conversation, Matt, with Adrian and Rob. And man, that was a lot of fun. We actually, it was back in the bento box of all places.
Oh, Raimi at RaimiFilms.com. That guy's a genius and haven't seen him forever.
Well, you know what? It almost brought tears to my eyes because I miss Raimi and I'm sure he's somewhere with a big beard. Just enjoying life, long hair, and editing a lot of films. Actually, I'm sure he's probably still doing some work. Just some they call that the long shot.
Yeah. I wonder what's. I have to check in with Raimi. I can't wait to get back to the bento box. But it was a really good conversation. And man, took me back to the simpler times.
Right.
Of February 2020. Man.
Yeah.
Feels like a different decade.
For sure. And speaking of simpler times, Matt, moving forward, we are only going to be releasing one episode per week, just on account of...
We'll do two this week, though.
Two this week. So another one coming on Friday. But then next week, we're moving back to our weekly schedule. Every Wednesday night, an episode will be released. And the reason we're really doing that is just because we feel like, hopefully, we're doing this in kind of maybe a... Maybe we're too optimistic, but... We're kind of hoping that we're getting a little bit in front of this thing and our COVID coverage can relax a bit.
That's right. And you know what you said to me earlier, that after Easter, it kind of felt like there was that bookend on the feeling of almost the holiday COVID feel.
Right.
And it is true. Like I'm feeling busier, not obviously like normal for this time of year, but definitely taking more calls, dealing with a lot of things out there, including math and science class, and the weather's getting nicer, and I don't know how much more we could, you know, beat this COVID thing
to
in
death.
Terms of coverage.
Hopefully we beat really, it to death. Hopefully it was our podcast that beat it to death. I think we're all sick of hearing about it, or at least I am. But you know what? You're right. It is interesting. Like the sentiment seems, based on the conversations we've been having with people, that they might not be anxious to get back into the market, i.e. listing or buying, but they're definitely thinking about kind of real life again in a meaningful way. And some of the conversations I have had is, you know, people are kind of getting back to their day-to-day routine because they know at some point these restrictions are going to be hopefully lifted and real life is coming back. So we're excited about that, and I think collectively as a society, we're probably excited about that. So, moving forward, back to one episode a week, and looking forward to that.
That's right. The Vancouver Real Estate Podcast has taken the lead in going back to our old routine.
All right. Well, Matt, if anyone has any questions about buying or selling or just real estate in general, how can they get in touch with you?
They can but there's two ways. One is VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. That is our website. All of hundreds of episodes and all the resources we have live over there at that site. Go check it out, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Or you can give me a call at any time, 778-847-2854, or Matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574, or Adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or we also have that secret line, which the one thing that may remain secret.
Yeah.
And never return.
He's a bit of a big secret himself.
info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah. And shout out to Secret wherever you are. Thanks for editing these podcasts. And you should really reach out. Like, reach out using the info line yourself to us.
Take care.
Yeah, everybody, please mute your phones if you can, please.
And your toilets.
Councilor Dejanova, are you on the line?
Okay.
Councilor Fry?
Folks, we need everyone to mute your phones. We're hearing water in the background.
giggling. That's a nice way of describing it.
Buddy. I know. I was trying to.
Someone is doing council business on the toilet.
Okay. Okay, we'll start again.
We're being broadcast right now, folks.
2,000 Spaces for Radio.
Subscribe today.
Hey everyone, pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting.
Are you developing in the Lower Mainland? Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.